Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlossophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlossophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer Egon Williams.
Yeah, I knew you were going there, and I'm hella okay with that.
We got a great show in store. It is just Spencer and I this week, and you know what? That's not a bad thing. Going old school, the way
original.
It used to be. The OGs. No. we're coming together to bring you a new review on the most recently dropped entry in the Ghostbuster film saga, Ghostbusters Afterlife. So stick around as we dive into that, into the incredible things that we saw, some of the things that, you know, whatever our opinions and blah, 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 blah. But before we get into that, Spencer, why don't you give them opening credits?
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlossophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlossophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlossophy101.
That's right. You can check us out over at our website at filmlossophers.com, where we have over 290 episodes. We are fast approaching episode 300, and we're thinking of something really great to do. We just haven't thought of it yet, but we got something big planned. Just know that. Check us out, filmlossophers.com. Also, check us out wherever you stream podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora. We are everywhere where podcasts are heard. Give us a listen, drop us a subscription, drop us a line of what you think about the show. Give us a 5-star review. I think we deserved it. We worked hard for it. Right?
I mean, we do, yes.
We do. let us know. You can also let us know on all our social pages at facebook.com/filmlossophies, and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlossophy101. We'd love to hear your voice. We'd love to know what you think. This is going to be an interesting show. It's been a while since it's just been you and I, but the thing is, we're still going to have a great conversation. And,
of course.
And not to mention, this movie is probably a movie that resonates with both of us in profound ways. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, this movie's even impacted, like, you know, pop culture and everything else in between. So, you know, who doesn't know about the infamous Ghostbusters, the sad entry in 2016, and this year's release, Ghostbusters Afterlife? We got a chance to check it out. Spencer, obviously, again, like always, went to the drive-in to go see it. I went to the theaters. And we got a chance to see it this past weekend, and needless to say, I think I can speak for both of us when we were pleasantly surprised at what we got and pleasantly surprised at some of the reviews and the things that critics have been saying. And it's just, it's all over the place. And we'll dive into that as well, because it's really kind of shocking and interesting all at the same time. But yeah, before we dive into this conversation, we want to forewarn you, this is a spoiler-filled review, so we are going to talk about the things that we really want to talk about, because, I mean, hey, this is our show, not yours.
Plus, if you're avoiding spoilers, like, good luck to you, because it's going to be hard.
Exactly. So, without further ado, before we get further into the review, Spencer, why don't you give them that official synopsis goodness?
When a single mom and her two kids arrive in a small town, they begin to discover their connection to the original Ghostbusters and their secret legacy their grandfather left behind.
That's right. Directed by Jason Reitman, the film stars Carrie Coon, Finn Wolfhard, McKenna Grace, and Paul Rudd, while Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Ernie Hudson, Annie Potts, and Sigourney Weaver reprise their roles from the original films. Spoiler! director Jason Reitman is actually the son of the Ghostbusters Part 1 and Part 2 director, Ivan Reitman. So that's actually really cool. There had been this whole long-standing thing that Jason was like not wanting to follow in his father's footsteps. I believe there was even an interview he did back in 2009 where he at one point stated, you know, you wouldn't catch me dead trying to direct a Ghostbusters movie, like essentially something to that effect. He had no plans on it. It wasn't until he had this vision of what he wanted and he saw this image, and then obviously
was it after the 2016 film came out?
I wouldn't be surprised, like, seriously. It wasn't until after the very known actor Harold Ramis passed away that he kind of put together his thoughts, and thus we got this movie. And honestly, with a lot of the people that were a part of this film, many of them weren't really keen on returning. One of them, more vocal than the rest, Bill Murray, he actually had been reluctant to reprise his role as Peter Venkman for decades. So he did say in an interview afterwards that he finally chose to return because, quote, "The script is good. It's got a lot of emotion in it. It's got lots of family in it with lines that are really interesting. It's going to work." And it does. Mm-hmm. I mean, needless to say. Due to the controversy and financial failure of the remake of Ghostbusters back in 2016, any further sequels for that movie were abandoned, and prompted Sony to instead make a sequel to the original two films rather than another reboot. So, you know, there's that. But yeah, I mean, you got a lot of things going on with, you know, this particular movie and everything else that it's trying to do. So you have to kind of keep in mind, yeah, I kind of get where they were coming from in terms of not wanting to return, but at the same time, they're a part of that original crew. You can't really do a proper Ghostbuster movie without having any of these guys even being mentioned. And the very few mentions that were in that unique 2016 movie, I don't think you could qualify those as, like, inclusions. So, and we'll talk about the 2016 movie. We have a specific place in this episode to talk about this. So, this movie right here, Ghostbusters Afterlife, we're looking at a movie that came out, a little less than 20 years since the first one. The first one, like we said, came out in 1984. This one, 2022. So we're looking at least, 10, 20, 30, almost 40 years? Wait. 90s, 2000s.
I think so.
Oh my god. Almost 40 years since your original film dropped.
All right, well, I'm done now. I don't like these facts.
Spencer's like, no more. I want off this ride. One of the things I want to talk about, especially here on the show, is you and I, Spence, we grew up around the same time. And the thing is that we both had a strong affinity to particular 80s movies, like whether it was Ghostbusters, Back to the Future, you know, some people are huge fans of like the Brat Pack with John Hughes. What was your experience with the previous Ghostbusters films? Like, when did you see the first one?
I don't actually remember. I'm pretty sure I was like somewhere in like high school age when I saw the first one. And I don't know when I actually saw the second one. I don't think it was until years later because... you know how everyone's like, oh, the second one's not as good as the first one or whatever.
Yeah.
And even now, I don't fully remember the second one. I just remember something about a painting and it leaking or whatever. But, like, the first one, like, that was just a really great movie that was, like, you know, well put together and just, like, had lots of jokes and heart and then was also, like, you know, on the, like, the lightly scary side, and that was perfect for me without like being like, you know, into horror movie categories.
Well, yeah, so the first one, obviously we had Gozer and the gatekeeper and the keymaster, and you know, you had the incredible performances by like Rick Moranis and Sigourney Weaver. You know, we got a chance to see Annie Potts really flex that New York accent. And then in the second one, you had the painting of Vigo the Carpathian,
right.
Who essentially was like he was possessed in the painting of some sort, and he wanted a actual physical being to, I guess, you know, possess, so that way he could come about and rule the world again, i.e. Sigourney Weaver's baby. I don't really know how much time passed from the first film to the second film. I'm assuming it's kind of maybe in real time because the first one's in 1984 and then the second one's in 1989. So who knows? But either way, Sigourney Weaver had a kid, Cochina. but the whole film itself altogether, like both of them were really strong movies. You know, the first one is known for just everything that it does, like right out the gate. The second one's known for, you know, having the Statue of Liberty walk through New York City and then break through the goopy ceiling of the museum or whatever it is that has the kid locked up as well as the mom. So there's a lot of things in those first two that you're like, you have to really rewatch and be like, did I miss that joke as a kid? So you saw the first one when?
Oh, probably around high school, so like 2000s.
Okay, and then the second one?
Probably like 2009, I'd guess, somewhere around there, you know, when it showed up on Netflix, like in the early days of like, yeah, we're just putting whatever and nobody cares.
So when I was a kid, so I actually saw the first film at home when I was like maybe 3 or 4, because I remember right after the movie, they tried to do the real Ghostbusters cartoon series.
Oh, yeah.
I remember and that I had toys from both of them. Like, I had a huge, I remember I had this huge football-shaped toy chest that was just full of, like, you know, Ghostbusters toys from both the cartoon and the real show. I had the Ecto-1 little thing and the ooze, the gooey ooze for, like, Slimer and all that. Like, I remember all of that stuff. I'm pretty sure none of it lasted, but the collector in me is like, oh, I should have put them all in plastic bubbles. But yeah, like I remember this movie being one of the very first movies where special effect work and just the sci-fi aspect of it drew me in instantaneously. These movies are part of that like original few that I saw as a kid that I kept watching over and over, like, consistently, to the point to where I was like a religious watcher of the cartoon series too. So when I say that this movie is part of like the foundation of the reason why I love movies, it's because of those reasons. It's because, you know, this was one of those ones that I could always revisit for a good laugh over and over. Like actors like Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd, you know, were hilarious. You know, Harold Ramis's deadpan, you know, performances were great. Ernie Hudson playing like the guy who's like, I'm normal. I don't know what you guys are doing, but, you know, I'm just here to make a buck. And everybody at one point in time has this, you know, odd, you know, crush on Annie Potts at that time as your first nerd crush, if you will. So talking about this movie, we have gone through some things when it comes to the Ghostbusters legacy, if you will, from the movies to the TV series, the cartoon series, to even the video games, and then the recent attempt at what some people may call a film in 2016. And so needless to say, we've been through a lot as fans. I'm not going to lie. When this one was announced, I was a little hesitant from the jump.
Everyone was hesitant.
Yeah, it's like it's like getting out of a bad relationship. You've been hurt once. You don't want to get hurt again. You're going to like tiptoe precautiously towards the other thing, to whatever you're attracted to. And you're like, I want to like it, but I'm also not in the business of getting hurt again.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I was in that same spot.
So it's kind of just the way it goes. And so the fact that, you know, this movie dropped last Friday and getting a chance to see it, I was still hesitant all the way up until the morning of the theater.
Oh,
like
wow.
The morning of the day I was going to go see it. Because, I mean, like I said, with what Sony did in 2016, I the actresses in that movie, They're fine working folk. They're great in other things, but so many things were crushed in that movie.
So many things and so many wild choices too.
Oh, that's an understatement to the fullest. Like the whole idea of that movie was just I wasn't. There's a space in the show for this. I have to keep reminding myself. Yeah. So even the morning of, there was a, and this, we're not sponsored by Vudu, so I'm not trying to throw any whatever, but there was even a sale that morning on Vudu where you could buy the first two films and then buy this one for like $27, like buy, not just, you know. And so I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. Like, they're already doing, like, this pre-order thing, this pre-order package. And I was like, well, I could get it, and then, you know, I'll be able to rewatch it when it comes out, blah, blah, blah. But then at that same time, that little voice in the back of my head is like, but you haven't seen it yet. You know, and I just didn't want to be put in that situation again where I was like, I don't know how. I don't know how. I keep thinking I know how, but I don't know how. For some reason, the extended edition of that 2016 Ghostbusters...
There was an extended edition?
Yeah. And it landed in my Vudu for some reason. I feel like...
Mine too!
See, okay, so I'm not the only one.
No, they gave that out or something, because I'm like, why do I have this? I never would have bought it with my own money.
I would not have put any money towards that movie. And so, like, I was like, I don't want to have two Ghostbuster movies on my Vudu that I'm not going to see again. So I'm like, okay. So I was still hesitant even until like that, because I did an early morning showing. I wanted to go when nobody else was going to, like, wasn't going to be packed. So I'm like, I guess I'll just wait. But yeah, I was still super hesitant going into it, like right from the jump. I just wasn't sure of anything. Finn Wolfhard, he's a decent actor. He hasn't done a lot of film movies. He's done a few notable ones, but none that I would say lends to his, like, great ability to be whatever role he was going to be in this one. Yeah, he did Stranger Things, but this is not Stranger Things.
Correct.
McKenna Grace, she's done a couple things here and there. She played in that movie with Chris Evans. I forget off the top of my head. She played the kid version of Captain Marvel in the Captain Marvel movie.
Oh.
You know, there's a few things. Paul Rudd's hit or miss for me. I'm not the biggest fan of Paul Rudd. I don't think of him as, like, the most... I mean, mind you, he just got Sexiest Man Alive from whatever magazine. But... Or Sexiest Man of 2021 or 2020. I don't know. Yeah. Everybody was indoors. It might have been 2020. So I don't know which one it was. But he's hit or miss for me. I mean, it's not always on. You know, and then Carrie Coon, I wasn't all too familiar with. I'm not too sure. Apparently she was... oh my God, she played Proxima Midnight in Avengers Infinity War. Who would have thunk it? But, like, I'm not all too familiar with a lot of her work. So there wasn't a lot in there that really just kind of sold it for me quite yet. I mean, other than that weird cameo of Dan Aykroyd in the trailer when he's like, we're closed, and he closed, you know, hangs up the phone, or the scene ends. So needless to say, I just, there wasn't enough for me to really kind of bite down and be, like, sold on it. What about you?
Actually, that first, because before the first trailer came out, I was like, there's no way they're going to make this one work after the last one.
Yeah.
Like, I just did not see that coming. So after the first trailer came out, I was like, they might have something, but they probably don't, because I still don't trust them. So, like, I was, like, in this, like, kind of, you know, in between place of this might actually be good, because, like, I like to think that, you know, as people, we learn from our mistakes. But then, you know,
as a society,
well, like, sometimes people just be wrong and they've learned nothing. So, you know, I was coming in optimistic that they had hopefully learned something from the last ones.
Yeah. So, going into the review, and mind you, we have already warned you once. This is your second warning. There are spoilers that are going to be thrown about this entire review, so you're forewarned. First impressions right outside the gate. Spencer.
They learned something. So I was actually super happy.
They did it, Eureka.
No, I was really impressed. This was way better than I thought it, like even within, like, the range of what I thought it could be.
Yeah.
It was way exceeded that. I was like, this is fantastic. Why did the last, like, why did 2016 happen to us? Why?
Cinematically, 2016 was our 2020. But no, I agree. Like, right out the gate, like, this movie moved me. Like, not to sound cliche from a from a VeggieTales series, but it moved me, Bob. Like, it really did. Like, it brought back so many facets of that nostalgia factor instantaneously, even without having, like, anybody in it in those scenes that were from the original series. Like, every opportunity they could, just gleamed of nostalgia from that first film.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like, in the instances where you're watching this movie and you're seeing these kids discover this whole thing, it's like, yeah, that's how I was when I first discovered Ghostbusters. Like, I was in awe. I was like, oh, this is cool. What, you know, I wasn't like trying to, you know, it wasn't like watching someone try to use a proton pack in a back alley and get blasted away. 2016. But it was an instance where it was like, I was genuinely moved throughout the entire film.
Mm-hmm.
Friend of our show, Jack, whom you've heard before on it, host of Jack of All Flights podcast. I was texting him earlier and he goes, man, he goes, I cried. And I'm like, yeah, me too. Cause it's like, this movie just had that factor in it. Like, I was completely bowled over by everything this movie did. And I obviously, like I said about that Vudu deal, as soon as the lights went up, I jumped on Vudu on my phone and I bought that thing. So I'm like, I don't want to miss this. Let it be that one moment where that deal's going on. And as soon as I get on there, deal's over. Yeah, you have to pay full price now. this movie just had so many things going for it. Like, kind of diving right in, the actors were well placed, oddly enough.
Let's talk about McKenna Grace. She knocked this thing out of the park.
No joke. McKenna Grace is right now, where she stands, she is a force to be reckoned with as a performer. Everything she did in this role was superb. I could see, like, that lineage of... So you come to find out McKenna Grace, whose character is named Phoebe, is the grandchild of Harold Ramis's character, Egon Spengler.
Mm-hmm.
And so he ends up passing at the beginning of the movie. So you're like, okay. They move into the house, blah, blah, blah. You've seen the trailer. But McKenna Grace is literally the grandchild of Egon Spengler in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
From the same type of glasses they shared to the deadpan way of their delivery of jokes and stuff. This child was the funniest thing in this movie.
She's amazing because, like, she has trouble making friends. So, like, throughout the movie, she just, like, is giving, like, these very bad jokes, but with such good delivery that they make them hilarious.
They were wonderful jokes. I loved every single one of them. Like, oh my God, every single one that she gave was hilarious. I would just see that, like, that compilation of those jokes over and over in a long 2-hour stream on a YouTube channel. But no, she was fantastic in this movie. Her ability to emote and to really kind of just engage in the character and be someone who understands that not everybody fits in and it's okay. Not everybody is meant to fit in. And she is one of those people who is just so exceptional. She stands, like, way apart from everyone else. She gets the objective in the movie. The character gets the objective. She goes to do what she knows is needed. And yeah, she's such a great character in this movie. And needless to say, her sidekick, Podcast?
You mean my new favorite character in the Ghostbusters franchise?
That kid was phenomenal. I thought at first I was like, oh no, we're going to get somebody who's just going to kind of riff on podcasters in this movie and blah, blah, blah. I actually thought that in the beginning. Because he's sitting in class with a big old shotgun mic and just talking into it.
For that, I don't even understand.
No, I'm like, that's a Rhodes shotgun mic. Where did you get that from? But he's like, he's talking into his thing and whatever. and she's like, what's your name? It's Podcast. Why do you call that? Why do they call you that? And it's hilarious. And his whole, like, role in the movie is the obvious observation character. Like, he's like, oh yeah, we're trying to catch ghosts. Wait, what? And he's just hilarious throughout the whole thing. Like, I think one of the funniest parts in the movie, there's another one that I'll get to later, but one of the funniest parts is when Phoebe, McKenna Grace's character, and Podcast are talking and they're walking to her house, and she goes, well, maybe I'll listen to your podcast sometime. He goes, really? Wait, he's like, really, you will? And he digs into his pocket and he pulls out a little flash drive. He goes, it really picks up in episode 42 or something or whatever. I really find my... And I'm like, oh my gosh, this kid is gold. Yeah. Like, he's the next Archie from Jojo Rabbit. The little boy who's like with the,
oh,
like, I feel like they need to be in a movie together about yeah. something hilarious. Like, have them do a Goonies remake and have him be Data. Like, I would see cool. that. I would love that. But no, he's phenomenal in that movie. I think Finn Wolfhard, Paul Rudd, they're used in sparingly in throughout the film, which I'm not opposed to, because Finn Wolfhard is not to his detriment, because it's kind of the way his character is, but he was a little one note in the movie.
Yeah.
But that's not a bad thing. Like, he doesn't need to be like Super Mike from, you know, Stranger Things. He needs to just be Trevor, the brother who's awkward and, you know, at a, you know, young age in those teenage years, and is crushing on this other teenage girl that they work together with. You know, that's fine.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, like, for some of the characters, like, they did keep them in the background for, like, you know, this is their one thing. Like, the girl that he's chasing after, Lucky.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you can tell that she's supposed to be mischievous, but, like, she's, like, so far in the background that, like,
yeah.
you don't really get, like, a full sense of her character.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a shame, because, like, I did like what I saw, but, like, I feel like there wasn't, like, enough there to really, you know, make a character. Plus, it was also kind of weird that she kind of ended up being their fourth. And we're like, we don't really know enough about you, but okay.
Yeah. Your dad's a sheriff, but sure, let's hand you a proton pack or something. Like, that makes sense.
Hey, she did a jailbreak.
She did. She stole a cop car. That was pretty surprising. Like, okay, well, cool. Paul Rudd's one of those ones where used sparingly. He wasn't in every scene, but the scenes that he was in, he was actually good. Like, yeah. he played a somewhat down-to-earth type of individual. He wasn't trying to be extra. He was definitely crushing on their mom for, like, the good part of the film.
Yeah.
And then we get the great transition where he becomes the Keymaster. Spoiler alert. He becomes the Keymaster. And this is, I think, where Paul Rudd then begins to kind of thrive in the movie, because I feel like Paul Rudd completely, like, scrutinized and looked over constantly Rick Moranis' role as the Keymaster. Because Paul Rudd was doing the same kind of run that Rick Moranis was doing, the way his hands were moving. Like, he acted like Rick Moranis did when he became the Keymaster. Like, that awkward run where his hands are kind of flailing. And it was perfect. It was absolutely perfect. I mean, obviously, some of the other key roles that we have throughout the film, we'll talk about the other ones. There's not many people in the movie that, you know, you really get a chance to know.
Right.
Which is fine, because the story's not about them. It's about McKenna Grace's character and, you know, the people that surround her. Like I said, Carrie Coon really played an interesting mom. Like, one of those types of moms where you obviously know she had a hurtful past as a child, and so she doesn't want to be that type of person. She wants to give her kids a little bit of freedom, but also not to the extent where she lets them do dangerous and ridiculous things, even though they do them in the movie, I guess. Yeah. Either way.
Yeah, very place.
She was good though in the movie. The movie really does move in a very unique direction. It's not, here's the odd thing. There's not a lot of context for the story. There's not a lot of content in the story. It's a very simple story. You know, family's grandfather, family's estranged grandfather passes away. Family inherits home, has to live there because they can't live anywhere else. You know, awkward stay, things happen. Youngest kind of gets a hold of stuff that she probably shouldn't, but ends up reigniting a apocalyptic event that was, you know, hinted at in the first film. Event occurs, and it is up to her, with the guidance of her, you know, spirit grandfather, to do what needs to be done. Like, in the simplest, you know, way to put it, that's what the film is. But a lot of people, and this is the weird thing, this is what I was mentioning earlier. Do you know this thing has like a 63% on Rotten Tomatoes?
No.
Like, the critics' ratings. Like, no joke. Yeah, I was
like anything.
Right? It's like, are you serious? This is not, you know, this isn't anything like 2016. This is a decent movie, but yeah, like, let me see, I'm pulling it up right now. Oh, I'm sorry, it's gone down 1%.
Oh, great.
whatever. But like, it's got like a 63%, if you look right there, 62% on Rotten Tomatoes. But the audience score is at 95%, which means the people who actually are paying to go see it are saying it's good. The people who got in for free are saying it's meh. And I'm like, why? Like, after the movie ended, I was like, oh man, this thing's probably gotta have great reviews. And someone's like, you know, it's got like a 60% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. And I'm like, no way. And I jumped on my phone, and sure enough. But it's like, why? I don't get why people are not liking it. But when I usually have these kind of quandaries in my mind, it's usually within the confines of this. I try to see both sides of every situation, so that way when I talk about it here, or when we talk about it here, I can say, well, okay, I can see this side and I can see that side. And so, you know, that's probably why this or that. But for the life of me, I can't think of a single reason why any critic wouldn't like this movie. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. It's almost ridiculous, because this movie does nothing but kind of just good and great things. I mean, it gives a sense of kind of, not to sound cliche, as one of the songs in the soundtrack is called Reconciliation, but it does. It gives a little bit of reconciliation for the franchise so far. It gives closure. It gives opportunity for, you know, new blood and old blood to kind of work in the same, you know, arena in terms of, you know, the Ghostbusters. And it just does things that we haven't seen yet in a new iteration or continuation of the franchise. So I don't really get it, and it's kind of frustrating, because to be a Rotten Tomatoes critic, you got to go through a lot of stuff. Like, there's a lot of hoops you got to jump through. You got to have X amount of reviews every year. You have to submit your application at a certain time, and so you have to be invested in film, like going to see these movies. These people who are those types apparently didn't see something good coming out of this movie. And the sad thing for me is, I don't think a lot of them even understood the assignment. Like, I was reading a few of the reviews, and one of them was like, oh, this is just another reboot that blah, blah, blah. And this is, I'm like, this is not a reboot. You work for the Chicago Tribune. This is not a reboot. This is actual continuations of the story. So I don't know. It really bothered me that peers of ours who work in this same industry of reviewing film are kind of just bagging on it, you know? I don't know. What do you think?
Like, here's the thing with me. Like, I always seem to differ from, like, critics on, like, big movies, it seems like. There's, like, movies where, like, this movie is great, and I'm like, this movie sucked. And then there's other movies where, like, this movie sucked, and I'm like, this movie is great. You guys are crazy. And so that's one of the reasons why I like being on the podcast, because I can get my own opinion out there.
There you go.
So, like, honestly, it's not that surprising to me.
Yeah, and it's just, I don't know, it really does speak towards the small-mindedness of some folk, where looking past, because, yes, as our job of critics, we are to kind of scrutinize the film from a logistical perspective as well as a cinematic perspective, and kind of find somewhere in between where the two meet and give a good possible rating. And I don't know, some people are just like, oh, this was just, you know, we don't need this, just unnecessary fan service, or, you know, but it's haunting, but not in a good way. Like, oh my gosh, what? It just, I don't know, it frustrated me. But talking about the story, even though it didn't have a lot of, like, content towards the story, I still really feel like this thing had a lot going for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had a new iteration of Slimer named Muncher.
Yes.
Which was voiced by Josh Gad.
Did you know that? I saw that.
Yeah, I was like, that. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, Olaf in a new form. you had opportunities to see, like, someone who's never even seen a proton pack fire a proton pack in the middle of a field, and thankfully didn't get blasted back like some people.
Kind of thought she was about to be.
Yeah.
Oh, those things seem like they have a kick to them.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, the rumble in that thing sounds like it's like a Buick starting up. But
oh yeah, also that made me super uncomfortable when they just power that thing on. Like it seemed like it was like, I was like, ooh, I hope this does not explode.
I was gonna say if it explodes on that child, that was like a nuclear bomb strapped to their back. This movie just had a lot of things in it that just brought it brought back the feeling that I had as a kid when first discovering, you know, Ghostbusters. It's crazy. But what I really wanted to talk about is like how it compared to previous Ghostbuster films.
Specifically the 2016
one? And I know there are people out there who really like the 2016 film. I mean,
I have questions.
What
about why they liked it? Like, not to be rude or anything, but like,
no. Like,
what did they get from this movie? Is like what I would like to just know.
Like, if you wanted to experience a Ghostbusters movie in your generation, if you're a newer film, you know, viewer, like if you're someone who's within the last decade, you know, brand spanking new to the world, and this was your opportunity to experience a Ghostbusters movie, just go back to the first one, like. Honestly, I don't know. Like the different aspects, like the 2016 one was a full on reboot. It wasn't even just a continuation because everybody who pops up as a cameo from the original squad are either, you know, Dan Aykroyd is a taxi driver.
Yeah.
Winston is the uncle to what's her name? The actress's name?
Leslie Jenkins?
Yeah, Leslie Jones.
Oh, Jones.
Leslie Jones, I think. I think. We might be going to mix it up. I don't know. Leslie. the uncle to Leslie. And then you had Bill Murray, who was like a debunker, like a ghost debunker, that looked like a hipster to some effect. And it didn't really mesh well. All the while, you change out Annie Potts and you put in Chris Hemsworth.
Like you could have a whole section to this podcast dedicated on what the heck was happening with Chris Hemsworth in this movie. Made zero sense.
It made absolute zero sense. I don't get it. Like and it makes me wonder. I wonder what it's. I'm afraid to even look. What does Ghostbusters, that one have in terms of Rotten Tomatoes score? Oh my God, it's got a 74%.
From the critics or the audience?
No, from the critics, but from the audience has a 49%.
Yeah, that sounds about right. This is exactly what I was talking about. Like, I'm like, how are you getting these numbers, people?
It just doesn't make sense. Yeah, Leslie Jones. The whole movie itself just really does push the idea of it being a Ghostbusters movie without really kind of landing in that Ghostbusters vein.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and honestly, I don't think we've ever reviewed that Ghostbusters movie.
We have not.
Good. Because it's hard to watch.
You know what? It is. Because like I remember I was watching it and this was at my house. I'm like, I just took frequent breaks. Because I was like, I think a lot of those jokes were so cringy in that
movie. Yeah.
And I was like, every time one was like, okay, I need a 10-minute break because you should not have said that.
some of the little like the little instances were, oh, they're doing this dance that they did when they were in fourth grade or whatever during a science fair, or you know, Leslie Jones and just being like, oh, I just want to be a part of this, and but not really being a part of it, and kind of being the part of the comedic brunt of the joke in certain instances where she was left alone, or Kate McKinnon's character was probably the only one that really kind of kept me somewhat engaged. Just very awkward and just more focused on the science. I guess she was the Egon character.
Yeah.
But the rest of them, I just couldn't get into. Like, it just didn't sell it for me. And even the big crescendo part of which is the entire third act, because apparently in order for you to make ghosts you need to show people killing themselves. That was an interesting way to go, because that guy kills himself in the basement of the hotel.
All right.
And then his spirit, I guess, possesses Chris Hemsworth, Right. And then there's a dance sequence at one point in time.
Because being a ghost gives you control over people.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've seen the movie, so there's an actual explanation.
I mean, I don't think you're really getting anything wrong, though. I don't know. And the inclusion of, like, okay, you have, like, this family of Slimers, and then you get the big ghost symbol as a, you know, as an actual, I don't even, it, ghost, because the thing is, they weren't really, it kind of turned into a Scooby-Doo movie towards the tail end. It looked like most of the Scooby-Doo movies. It just was hard to watch. And then even when at the end, when you're like, oh, they're in peril, Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy are in peril, and they're going to fall in this demonic hole, I was like, is that a bad thing? Like, if they go, whatever, with the inclusion of, like, Andy Garcia as the mayor of New York City, and it seemed like it was just an SNL reunion with Ghostbuster costumes. Because, I mean, literally, just about every single main person in this movie was, or currently is, a cast member for SNL. I mean, you had Melissa McCarthy, Kristen Wiig, Leslie Jones was on SNL, mm-hmm. Kate McKinnon, Cecily Strong, she was on SNL as well. I mean, it really did push the boundaries of what they were really trying to achieve. I don't know, man. That movie's just really a hard pill to swallow. Obviously, we're not the only ones who believe so, as it's got a 49% rating. Oh, with over 100,000 ratings, it's at 49%. So, makes sense, yeah. But even outside of that, going back to the other films, like the previous Ghostbusters movies, like 1 and 2, I felt like it did... A lot of people are saying, oh, it had no ties, or it didn't emulate anything from the previous films. I feel like it did. You know, I really did feel like the essence of, you know, finding there's an issue, finding that you can create something, or there are things that you can use to help, you know, solve this issue with the ghost problem and the looming dread, which is essentially the big issue with, you know, in the first one, you know, the looming dread of Gozer, you know, and then the release of all the monster, all the ghosts from the tank or whatever it's called. You know, and them having to go out into the city and, like, saving everybody. That was all part of this whole, you know, idea as well. And I felt like it really did. It did great giving honor to that, but at the same time, it also still led on a unique foot. we were talking about McKenna Grace and those jokes, and my other favorite scene is her approaching Gozer while Gozer's on the throne, and all she's doing is saying these weird jokes one after another. Like, that's all she's doing.
Pretty great part of the movie.
That was an incredible part of the movie, and I'm like, yes, keep going. It's like that John Mulaney sketch or John Mulaney stand-up routine where he's talking about, I don't know if you've ever seen that, where he's talking about Law & Order SVU, and he's like, and he goes, and I just love it when, you know, Ice-T, who has been on the force for so many years or whatever, and in every episode is still learning stuff about his job. He's like, when they were explaining some crime to whatever, and Ice-T's like, oh, you mean it's like when someone buys too many scratchy lottery tickets? Or like, and he's like, and I would listen to Ice-T give comparisons to this for hours. And he's like... You mean it's like when someone likes too much chocolate cake, or like, and that whole scene with McKenna Grace and Gozer, mm-hmm. I want extended. Like, I want an hour extended of that. Like, I want Gozer to just finally crack a smile at some point because one of them hits. But it's a great scene, and it's a great way to approach that type. I mean, she doesn't know how to handle social situations like that, so she does what she did best: recite the jokes that she's been memorizing. The whole movie is just a constant love letter to what we held dear way back when with the original films and everything. And the every instance where you had a character who was like all aghast or like in awe of the tools or the things that they had, like the proton packs or the ghost catcher or whatever, like every time you saw somebody who's like, oh my God, is that a whatever, blah, blah, blah. It's like, that's how we are with even people who just cosplay. Like, oh my God, is that a proton pack? Turn around and grabbing cosplayers and, you know, it's not consent. But still, like seeing people who have that kind of stuff, even the people who like turn their cars into Ecto-1s and like roll around with it. It's like, I envy those people. Like, that's really cool. And this is one of those movies where it honors those types of people. It honors that group of people, those of us who would just go nuts to own a proton pack. I mean, for God's sakes, one of the best builders in the, one of the best, like, you know, builders in the world, Savage, Adam Savage, mm-hmm. has gone on for many, many years about how much he loves those original movies and him making like an original proton pack, an original ghost catcher, the original jumpsuit. He goes out and he cosplays and does all that kind of stuff. And it's like, that's cool. That's somebody who, Adam Savage is somebody I look up to. I know it's somebody you look up to. And it's like, to know that his affinity to Ghostbusters holds no bounds to the point to where he's like in awe of it, to where he makes the actual pretty much spot on replicas of the original. It's like, yeah, I'm in that same boat. I would love to own a proton pack. I would I would kill to see a real one, you know. But it's one of those. This is one of those types of movies that honors rather than tries to imitate, which is what we had with the 2016 one. Mm-hmm. You had people who were trying to just imitate a formula that already worked, like. They hit gold with that first and second Ghostbusters, you know, with the perfect casting of, you know, Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, you know, Ernie Hudson, Rick Moranis, Annie Potts, Sigourney Weaver. They were great at what they were doing, and it just worked wonderfully. Doing a whole recast, trying to capture on that kind of idea, that kind of character structure. You can't create another Bill Murray. You definitely can't create another Dan Aykroyd, nor can you create another Ernie Hudson or a Harold Ramis. You know, unfortunately,
yeah, all those guys are really hard to replace.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you look at all the movies that they've done outside of Ghostbusters, and there's not many of them that were remade because you can't really remake that style of acting, that style of character performing. I was talking about it with someone the other day. They were asking, we were talking about Total Recall, and they were like, wait, isn't that the one that got remade? I'm like, no, that was, no, it was Total Recall. No, they had mentioned The Running Man, and they're like, isn't that the one that got remade? I'm like, no, that was Total Recall.
Didn't they think about doing The Running Man again?
God, I hope not. but like, the Total Recall movie that was remade with Colin Farrell was horrible. It was just bad. Because everything that made the first one so much fun was because of Arnold Schwarzenegger and all of his ridiculous one-liners and the things that he would say and how he would proceed in certain ways. Colin Farrell is not Arnold Schwarzenegger, like in performance or in figure. You know, by all means, he's not, and I'm pretty sure he knows it. So trying to recapture that in other people and other actors, that was doomed to fail from the start. Mm-hmm. But in this, they're not trying to recreate the actors. They're trying to give honor to the actors that are, you know, that were a part of this franchise, you know, which that's kind of where we lead towards like the big spoiler part of the review in the idea of like how the film ends, you know, and how we get this. Obviously we know that Harold Ramis has passed, the actor who played Egon Spengler,
right.
And you get this opportunity where they try to use the same tools that he did to try to capture Gozer and try to, you know, vanquish Gozer once and for all. And it doesn't work. And, you know, they're all of a sudden you get this wonderful, incredible appearance by Bill Murray, Ernie Hudson, and Dan Aykroyd in full on gear, and Dan Aykroyd doing his Dan Aykroyd thing, and Bill Murray being wonderful and Ernie Hudson being incredible. And they all show up and they help McKenna Grace try to capture Gozer. And at the same time, McKenna Grace, who's starting to lose grip, you get this incredible moving, and it was so moving because I'm like, oh my God, I am not gonna cry. And I am crying because you get this you know, astral kind of figure of Harold Ramis coming and helping McKenna Grace hold tight to the proton pack, and I'm like, God dang it, I said I wasn't gonna cry. And it's just, it's so beautiful because you get this kind of amazing last opportunity to say goodbye to Harold Ramis as a performer, as an actor, as a human being. And it's so great because the opportunity even for the guys to see him one last time in that lineup as he's just standing there, and it's like,
that's pretty good. They just all slowly start looking over him.
Yeah, and they're like, we should have called. We should have believed you. We should have been there. And it's like, I said I wasn't gonna cry, you know. And it's, but it's so beautiful. It's like, I'm pretty sure in some aspects, like even they got a chance to, like, to say goodbye in that way too. You know, those guys in a certain special kind of way. And it really does give so much back to this franchise that was so needed. And even if this is the last film that they do, because I'm kind of hoping it is, I'm kind of hoping it isn't, I don't know how they would proceed.
Well, I mean, those end credit scenes kind of set up how they would proceed.
True. Yeah, like, because like we get a great mid credit scene where Sigourney Weaver is using the same set of cards and the machine that Bill Murray was using in the first film, where he was trying to test people how to use how to pretty much see if they were psychic or whatever.
Yeah,
and it's a great back and forth scene, and you got to see it; it's wonderful. But the end credit scene, you come to find out that Winston has become this like multimillionaire, invested in this company. It became like a worldwide conglomerate, essentially. And he ends up buying the old firehouse, and you know, he brings in the old Ecto-1 to work on it, and they show the basement where we had mentioned previous, the basement where it held like the locker, if you will, for the ghosts or whatever, and it was beginning to blink red, and I believe that means like it's like at capacity or something, or it's about to explode or something. Am I getting that right?
I don't remember what it is, but usually red's bad.
You got a point. Usually red is bad. And it leads to this idea that, you know, he's reacquiring the old firehouse for some reason, and who knows what that reason may be, you know? And if they take off from there, that'd be fine as well. I mean, I don't know where the future holds for this movie, but I know the way it wrapped up really spoke to a lot of the people that I was in the theater with, mind you, which wasn't many, but a lot, there was older folk and there was younger folk, and it's like, this movie speaks across all platforms. Like, it just really does a wonder to connect two generations that are so separated, that aren't really too, you know, close in terms of age range, but when you put them together into a room, people know the Ghostbusters, maybe in some good ways and some bad, but in this opportunity, you can combine both of those into one wonderful, you know, visual, you know, experience. So I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. As a wrap up, like, I don't know. This movie does like a good job, I feel, of like bringing in new people while not keeping them out, because, you know, sometimes like with franchises, you know, it can be harder for like newer people to get into them because it's like, you know, there's all this backstory, you don't know it, but like,
yeah,
this one does like a pretty good job of being approachable even if you don't know exactly, like, you know, but like probably like Dan Aykroyd was in the older ones, but like this is kind of like a good introduction,
yeah,
for these characters, for and for people to go back to the old movie. So I feel like they did a really good job with that.
Yeah Did you have any highlights or things that you, or issues with this movie?
Okay. So here's my issue.
Oh boy.
It's more of a lack of understanding. Like, I feel like there's a story here and they didn't go deep enough into it. And it's this whole thing where Egon felt that he had to just up and leave and not really explain what he was doing to like the other Ghostbusters. Like, that comes across as just a little bit weird to me. Because, like, of anyone on the planet who's like, I have to go fight these ghosts. Those other three guys are going to be the guys who believe you. So yeah, that was the part that was like really odd to me, that he felt he had to do this by himself.
I think the idea of Gozer became such a fixation for him, mm-hmm. that recognizing the telltale signs of Gozer returning and Egon being the type of person who doesn't always translate well, but the fact that he translated as best as he could in terms of like what Doomsday was meaning and how it would come about, and the fact that I think at a point where it just didn't seem like he was gonna get the help he needed, just decided to spare everyone else the life of having to constantly be in this town to do this daily, because it essentially was Egon, because you had to figure at some point in time he started out small and then worked his way up to creating the fixtures that he had to be able to hold back Gozer from becoming, you know, from becoming a reality again. Mm-hmm. It took years, it took his life to create all that and to make sure it was maintained and that it wasn't something that people would stumble upon or you know, go back to. I think the idea of it was he would rather carry this torch alone and be kind of the knight of the Holy Grail, if you will. Just like in The Last Crusade.
Yeah, but the thing about this is he's a really smart guy. He, of anyone, should know that this is not sustainable. This is not something that's going to last for hundreds of years.
Well, I mean,
that's why you have to kind of like, you have to take care of the problem, not just like keep it at bay.
True, but who knows? That's actually a really great point. It really does beg to ask the question, you know, what the thought process was in terms of making that decision.
Yeah, honestly, like, that's all I want. I want like a mini episode or something. Like, what was the thought process of when you got here? Because that was the only thing I had a really hard time with, like, during the movie and even after it.
Where, yeah,
I was like, I don't fully get where you're coming from. But I also feel like that's almost in character for me, yeah, to not fully get it.
I think the same way as you do in terms of that. Like, I feel like Egon's just one of these types of people where, in terms of him translating the needs that he had, he could only explain it in either like the intellectual terms or the philosophical terms. Mm-hmm. And if people didn't get it, it's like you trying to explain Mass Effect to somebody who's never played a game. Like, if you had to explain how the last third of that game goes, and all you knew were just the terminology of Mass Effect and everything, and you had to explain weapons, you had to explain all these, could you do it consistently to where somebody could get it if they've never played a video game before, or if they weren't even aware of the idea of the video game Mass Effect?
A very light explanation, yes.
But I mean, if the fate of the world hinged on them learning this,
and, oh well, that's way different. Then you have to be very detailed oriented. So,
but if they're, yeah, not getting the details,
yeah.
So I feel like Egon may have been on the spectrum, possibly, you know, or something. Maybe just not in the ability to and who knows at what age that was when he decided to. I mean, it couldn't have been too old, but old enough to where he had to have at one point had a family already established, and then when the mom was young enough, he left, which means that he had been out in the dirt farm. They call him the dirt farmer. He was a dirt farmer for at least 30 years.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah. So I don't know. There's a lot to kind of comb through that, and it's true. I think a little bit more explanation on that would have kind of helped understand, but I think, in retrospect, with the way the film ends too, I think not having that be the priority while you're having final goodbyes, like, wait, before you go, Egon, why didn't you just tell us this kind of crap was going to, yeah,
send a photo of the game,
right? Email, please. Yeah. Any other thoughts? Any other issues or highlights?
Really, that's my only real issue with this movie that I really take away. What about you?
A couple of the highlights. I liked the additions to the Ecto-1 that they did, like
the gunner seat.
The gunner seat, And then the little trap door for the little remote control ghost catcher.
Yeah.
Like, that was great. That was perfect. I'm like, I would have loved to have seen that in action in the first two films. The idea, like, us just seeing towards the tail end of the film of the Ecto-1 going across the Manhattan Bridge or one of the bridges going into New York City, it kind of, like, just felt like, okay, the Ghostbusters are coming back to New York kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it really, that kind of jolted the whole mindset of, oh, I wonder where they're going with this. Like, it could go anywhere. But I think the only issue I had was that we didn't get a lot more interaction with more ghosts. Like, I maybe wanted to see a little bit more, like, ghost catching outside of, like, chasing Muncher around the city.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure that's going to be something, or maybe they'll bring it up later, because there was a bunch of really cool looking ghosts and designs that they had, like that one with the big old eye that shows up in the middle of the street.
Yeah.
I maybe there's an opportunity to see them try to catch that at some point in time. I wanted to see more of that, but I also know with the amount of time they had, and they only had a limited amount of time. I mean, this movie was already 2 hours.
Right.
So any more than that, and it's approaching endgame status.
Yeah, which is too much.
Yeah, definitely too much. But other than that, in terms of other issues or things, like, I don't really have a lot of issues about the film. I enjoyed it. I loved it, you know, and I'm really excited to see more and more fans be more vocal about it, because apparently they're the only sane ones who are talking about the movie. The critics are just redonkulous. And that begs me to ask the question, like, when it comes to future films, when it pertains to classic movies, do you think they should push forward? Because we've already seen it with Halloween, the 2019 Halloween movie, as a continuation and not a remake. Do you think they should focus more on continuing the story or maybe just remaking it?
Okay, so I feel like this is a very complicated question, because, like, just viewing, like, movies over history, people end up all over the spectrum here of, like, this movie's good and this movie sucks. But generally, I think movies that are continuations of previous stories tend to work better than reboots, because reboots have a tendency of being the exact same story again, while sequels can, like, continue the story but, like, have a new twist. Like, in this movie with, like, the gunner seat. Like, simple ideas that, like, you know, really add some variety to, like, a story you already know. Or even take, like, things that, like, walk the line between both. Like the 2009 Star Trek movies. Those were reboots and also sequels in, like, a really interesting way. And I feel like they kind of worked as both, because, like, even though it was a story you already knew, like, in that movie, because it was an alternate timeline, they did different things, which added some flavor to it. So it's a really fine line to walk, really.
So what you're saying is, if it's done properly with respect to the source, they could remake it. But if they want to continue the story, that's also probably a safer and stronger solution.
I mean, with remakes, though, I feel like those are the ones that really have the hardest time, because, like, why am I going to go see the same movie I've already seen? That's, like, that's really the remakes, like that's the question you have to defeat first if you're making a remake. Why are people going to go see your movie now versus just watch the original one? Mm-hmm. And, like, usually it ends up being like, oh, we can do, like, lots of more things and special effects. And I'm like, that's, special effects do not sell. Well, do not always sell a movie.
Marvel
movies do special effects being their only thing, but, like, even those are the lesser ones.
Well, hold on. Special effects and misleading trailers. Get it right.
Oh, yes. Disney.
No, I agree wholeheartedly. I feel like if you're going to take films. So right now, I feel like we're in this era where the things that were cool for us as kids are becoming cool for nowadays, because this generation is starting to realize, or a portion of this generation is starting to realize, that we had cool stuff. Like, just plain and simple, we had really cool stuff, and they want it. They want to emulate it. They want to recreate it. And mind you, in certain aspects, I can see how it sometimes works as a reboot. Like, the reboot has to actually be so well maintained that you have to not only have the passion for it, but you also have to have the appreciation and respect for the source material. You can't right. just say, you know, oh, I'm going to do this, and you know, I saw it when I was a kid. We can do it better. Like, you're right. Most movies that sell like that are based solely on their ability to wow you with effects or the star cast that they've gotten on set. And I don't know if that's always the winner. That's usually never the winner, especially when it comes to precious gems like movies like that. Like, if they ever decided to remake the Back to the Future movie,
I would be in line to protest this movie. Position one.
I could see that, truly. And this is where, like, you have to draw the line in the sand where how far does creating a remake go from honoring to scavenging, you know, just taking the ideas of it without actually giving back to the original storyline. And I think that's why, like, with movies we've had recently, like with Halloween, and like I mentioned, Halloween and this one, where it's almost like a spiritual sequel, a spiritual successor to those films, you're given an opportunity to not only still enjoy the cast and the people that are in this film, but you're also able to relish in the honoring that these movies do with its past films, with its past, you know, material, its past source material. It's really hard to kind of find that really, really fine line of balancing both in a reboot without it just becoming another sequel, mm-hmm. you know? And I say that with the whole respect towards anybody who's ever tried, minus the people who did the Sony 2016 Ghostbusters. It just feels like if you're going to create a reboot, you need to make sure you have invested every amount of your efforts and your research time and your study in not only the characters that made it, but the source of where it came from, the writers, the producers, the directors, everybody who has ever had a hand in it. You need to know what they were thinking, how they were going about this, what they were trying to, you know, impress upon when people were watching this scene and that scene. And it's really hard to kind of see success in any of that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. It's really it's really few and far between when you see decent remakes. Like take, for instance, like the Dawn of the Dead movie, the one in like 2004, I believe. It was actually good. It lent itself to really kind of revitalizing the zombie genre. The Jeff Bridges True Grit movie was a great one. It's like there's a few far in between that really do try. Some of them don't always hit the mark. Like, I think one of the best examples of hitting the mark and making it a successful, not only film in the reboot aspect, but also a successful reboot franchise, was the Ocean's 11 franchise, where the original with the original Rat Pack,
mm-hmm.
compared to the, you know, recent, I believe it was 2001, Ocean's 11 with George Clooney, Brad Pitt, you know, Casey Affleck, all of them, Don Cheadle. It was great, and it worked out really well. And I don't know. Those are moments where you can look and say, okay, those were good, but because of the fact that it didn't do an overabundant amount of work to try to replicate what the first one did or the original did, it built upon it, honoring that which was past. And we can get into things like, you know, Godzilla as well, the Planet of the Apes franchise, even one of the more popular ones with the James Bond series. You know, that one's hit or miss as well, but there have been successful ones that remake. And, you know, all in all, I would say, like, if you're going to remake a movie, and I think you asked it perfectly, you know, why should people come and see yours?
Mm-hmm.
That's just the most important question to ask. And if you can't really differentiate the question in terms of, you know, coming up with a really good answer and differentiating the answer from how much it'll make compared to how much fans will like it, then maybe your answer should be probably not to do it.
Yeah, see, this has like been my problem with like a lot of the Disney live action remakes.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think I've seen any of them because I'm like, why? Like, why should I go see these? And usually I don't really get a good enough answer.
Yeah, yeah, so. Yeah. So, wrapping this whole thing up, I want to go across the table, start with you, Spence. Does the film pass or fail, and how many monocles? This should be really easy for both of us, so I'll go ahead and let you go
yeah,
first.
Yeah, movie definitely passes. Like, it was a surprising watch. Like, I was just shocked at how much better this, like how much this movie had improved over the last one. And we will never speak of it again because it was just so bad. But like, yeah, this movie just has so much heart to it. Really great characters and just a really good story. And it pays like a great homage to the original actors, especially Harold Ramis. Like, there's not much to not like of this movie, so it's going to get 4.5 for me.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic job.
I agree. This movie passes for me without a doubt. This movie has everything that I wanted it to be and then some in terms of creating a very powerful story, simple in form but strong in nature. It brought back all the nostalgic moments that I wanted and didn't know I wanted and needed. Mm-hmm. And it created a memorable moment that crescendoed into this beautiful remembrance of what was once a staple in my childhood. So I absolutely loved it. It's definitely a pass. I'm going to give it a 5, even though I did give it a little bit of I had a little bit of an issue with it not having enough ghosts. Still, this movie is a movie that I plan to rewatch. As soon as it is released on digital, I will have a copy and I'm going to watch it. And I will make sure to tell people about it and to spread the word because of the fact that this is a great movie. There should be no reason why anybody has any negative remarks about it. Nobody! So, but yeah, that's my view. And you know what? I really did have a great time with it. And obviously you did too.
Yeah.
So that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmosophers. Like we said, you can check us out anywhere where streaming podcasts are available on iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, anywhere you find podcasts, we are there. The Filmosophers, check us out. Give us a subscribe. Let us know if you like it or not. And if you feel it so worthy, give us a 5-star review. We'd love to hear it. You can also check us out on our website at filmlosophers.com. We got over 290 episodes approaching fast to 300, and we got something great in store. It's a surprise we can't tell you because we don't even know the surprise yet, but we will soon. And once we get an idea, we'll let you in. We also have, you can also check us out on our social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. Give us a follow. Let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts, even on ideas for upcoming episodes. Let us know. We're definitely open in the market to hear ideas and what you have to say. Thanks again for joining us tonight in this great conversation about Ghostbusters Afterlife. And if you had your own opinions about the movie, or if we are completely off base when it comes to the 2016 movie and you absolutely feel like it was a masterpiece, please let us pay for your head to get examined. Because no, let us know your thoughts. I want to know why and how that kind of goes about for you in terms of movies. Like, if it really did, you know, toot your horn and really get your grapes going, whatever. Like, by all means, I want to know why and how. And maybe we missed something. You know what? Hey, there's a possibility. I hear that there's apparently in that extended edition, it makes it a whole different movie. We're in an era where extended editions or special cuts have been changing the face of many movies, so who knows? Yeah. You know? But like I said,
I'd be surprised if they cut out enough from that movie that it makes way more sense, but okay.
Who knows?
Yeah.
So again, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, thanks for listening, and I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.